Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 16th of April. The military in Sudan tells civilians to stay indoors as heavy fighting erupts between rival army factions. At least 25 people are reported to have been killed. Germany switches off its last three nuclear power stations. And
either the Christian world decides to wake up and defend the land to the birthplace of Christianity, or we will lose it all and Jerusalem will be lost to Christians.
A special report on the escalating tensions between Christians and Jews in Israel. Also in the podcast, could ancient viruses we all carry in our DNA help us beat cancer? And we find out some of the stars set to perform at a special concert for the coronation of King Charles. After being subjected to decades of strongman rule, the people of Sudan are once again at the mercy of their nation's military. A power struggle between the ruler, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and his number two, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo Hemeti, has erupted into open conflict. The capital, Khartoum, was rocked by airstrikes and artillery exchanges as Hemeti's paramilitary force, the RSF, fought the army. The RSF claimed to have taken the presidential palace and airport. Iman is a British Sudanese doctor who was waiting at the airport to catch a flight.
After checking my luggage, getting my boarding card and everything, just went and looked out the window and I saw the rapid support forces. They had broken the metal fence and tens of vehicles just driving into Khartoum Airport runway. That's when we heard the gunfire, and very shortly after that, the earth was shaking. In the airport, the situation was chaotic. There were children crying. Soon different vehicles were coming. These were probably the Sudan army. Gunfire was very close. It was incessant and the mortars were just hitting.
Duar Tariq lives near the presidential palace in Khartoum. She described the scenes there as explosions erupted in the background.
I'm seeing the military air force above my neighborhood. I can see the military airplanes. They bombing over, I think, the military headquarters because it's a 15-minute drive from my home. So I can see from above the smoke going up really high in the sky and then we can hear the sound of the bombing. It's really heavy. In the middle of the three main fights, oh my God, it's flying over so close. Yeah, I think you can hear it now. My house is in a roof. We're just seeing this directly. The Naam! Angelo Tahit! Angelo Tahit! Angelo Tahit! I'm sorry, I can't talk right now. They're shooting live ammunition to the roof next to our house, and we're just now taking shelter.
Khartoum resident Duar Tariq. The Air Force has now called on people to stay indoors, while the Sudanese Doctors' Union told Reuters news agency at least 25 people had been killed. This latest outbreak of violence comes 4 years after the long-term ruler Omar al-Bashir was overthrown, with Sudan struggling to transition to civilian rule. The BBC's Mohamed Hashim has been talking to contacts in Sudan.
We're still hearing claims and counterclaims. We have a very murky picture with a situation where it's not clear who is on top at the moment. On social media, the rapid support forces appear to have the upper hand in at least the type of narrative. Since this situation developed a few days ago when the RSF deployed its forces in and around the northern city of Merawi, the RSF appeared to have framed a narrative that they are doing this because foreign forces that are present on the ground in Merawi, in this case Egyptian forces, are conspiring with the military to carry out some sort of a corrective move against the RSF. We don't know who started the shooting this morning. But what we know is that the military on their side, in their counteroffensive, they have showed pictures of General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan appearing to be in a control and command room with some other officers looking at the operations. The Air Force has been deployed in and around Khartoum. Now we need to bear in mind Khartoum is a city of millions, and the use of helicopter gunships and fighter jets in striking at various RSF locations in and around the city. This evening, we heard General Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, the commander of the RSF, accusing General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan in a telephone conversation with the Qatari Al Jazeera TV. He said that General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan is a criminal, liar, and a fraud, and he will arrest him like a dog and put him on trial.
And let's not forget, these two men were running the country, one as the leader, one as his deputy.
These two men, actually, their working relationship spans over two decades. These are men who coordinated over the campaign in Darfur in the 2000s that was labeled a genocide by the UN. These are the two men that were appointed in February 2019, the last appointment by Omar al-Bashir, setting up his security committee. As far as people in the ground that I've managed to speak to in and around Khartoum, they're telling me one thing. This is a fight between the generals who have been suppressing and oppressing us for the last 4 years. Many people will sit and watch it out, but it's a very tense and nervous situation in the capital. Outside the capital, the situation isn't clear. There are various reports of heavy casualties being sustained in Darfur, in Niala, and in Al-Fashir. We still have no confirmation because all the eyes have been focusing on the capital, Khartoum.
The BBC's Mohanad Hashim on the power struggle in Sudan. Germany's era of nuclear energy came to an end on Saturday as the country's three remaining reactors were switched off. Germany decided to stop using atomic power after the 2011 Fukushima disaster in Japan, and it set 2022 as a deadline enshrined in law by the then-Chancellor Angela Merkel. The invasion of Ukraine and subsequent hike in gas prices led that to being pushed back by a year. But now it's happened. The decision has been popular with anti-nuclear campaigners, but as our correspondent in Berlin, Jenny Hill, explains, the country is split on the issue.
This is an historic moment, and it's thrilled anti-nuclear campaigners. After 60 years, this country will no longer produce nuclear energy. There were celebrations outside one of the plants near Stuttgart. Activists here have long warned that nuclear power is dangerous. They worry about accidents and what to do with the radioactive waste.
It's a really important day for us. I've been fighting nuclear power for decades.
But many Germans, and surveys suggest they're in the majority, think Germany is making a big mistake. They see nuclear power as a cleaner alternative to fossil fuels. And many of this country's European neighbours, conscious that Russian gas is no longer an option, are expanding their atomic energy capabilities. Earlier, Markus Söder, Prime Minister of Bavaria, said it was irrational, ecologically and economically, to ditch nuclear at such a time. He warned that energy prices would rise. It'll take years, perhaps decades, to fully decommission the nuclear plants. Even as the highly specialised work begins, Germany is still at odds over whether this was the right decision.
Jenny Hill in Berlin. Now, he's been described by the media in India as a gangster. Former Indian MP Atiq Ahmed had been convicted of kidnap and was facing murder and assault charges. But in the past few hours, he and his brother were shot dead while in police custody. They were speaking to journalists live on TV at the time. I got the details from our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan.
I don't think many people in India would have ever seen such a shootout in live television. I was just watching some of these clips on social media where Mr. Atiq Ahmed and his brother were being brought to a hospital. Policemen were surrounding them and there were a lot of media workers. They were putting the mics in front of them asking a question about why he didn't attend the funeral of his son who was killed in a police encounter a few days ago. And then within seconds, you can see a gun coming into the frame. He was being shot, and then he falls down. There were three gunmen running around shooting, and the journalists were escaping for cover. One fell down, but his camera was still on. We could clearly see how these three people were targeting Atiq Ahmed and his brother. Police later said they had taken the three people into custody, and this happened while under police custody. So the state government, which is being ruled by the Hindu nationalist BJP, has a lot to answer.
So is he an opposition MP?
He was in one of the regional parties from the Uttar Pradesh state. He was an MP for a term, and he was also accused of several crimes of murder, assault. So he had a very checkered past. He was in a jail in the western Indian state of Gujarat. He was brought to UP only a few weeks ago for another kidnapping case, and he was convicted by a court of life imprisonment. And he went to the Supreme Court last month saying that his life was in danger, especially by police. He was alleging that the police might kill him. You know, in the state of Uttar Pradesh, since the BJP came to power under the Chief Minister Yogi Adityanath, he had taken a very tough line on what he described as criminals. More than 180 people have been shot dead by police, many of them from the minority Muslim community. And rights activists say they were nothing but extrajudicial killings, but the government refutes this.
Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan. Thousands of Palestinian Christians and pilgrims from around the world filled Jerusalem's Old City on Saturday to celebrate the Holy Fire ceremony, highlight of Orthodox Easter celebrations. This year, there's been anger over Israeli police restrictions at one of Christianity's holiest sites, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Church leaders have also complained of a rise of hostility towards local Christians, with priests harassed and spat on, as well as hate-filled graffiti and vandalism. Yoland Nell has this report from Jerusalem.
Among the huge crowds of foreign pilgrims heading along the Way of the Cross in Jerusalem's Old City, there are also local Christians. They're a minority in the Holy City, now feeling increasingly under threat from harassment and violence. In one church, a religious Jewish tourist vandalised a statue of Jesus. On Mount Zion, two ultra-Orthodox Jewish teens smashed headstones in the Anglican cemetery, and priests and processions are routinely spat at. Church leaders believe extremists have been emboldened by the rise of the Israeli far right.
It's happening because there is hatred and radicalization of a part of the Israeli society.
Bishop William Shomily is from the Latin Patriarchate.
I don't believe that it is a strategy of the new government to attack churches, but these young people who practice these offenses feel in some way protected because they have strong representatives in the government.
And with the religious procession passing through the narrow alleyways of the Old City, really it's a crush of people, and they're from all around the world. It's a reminder of how Jerusalem is so important for the Christian faith. But at the same time, the number of Christians living here has dropped from about a quarter of the population a century ago to under 2% today. There were chaotic scenes as a mob of Jewish extremists recently damaged an Armenian-owned restaurant. Christians complain that Jewish settlers are taking over more and more properties in the Holy City and feel that the growing hostility is meant to push them out.
One of the youngsters decided to climb the wall to take down the cross-bearing flag of the Armenian Patriarchate.
In the Armenian quarter, Setrag Balian tells me how he confronted a group of Jewish extremists. They left, but later returned, he says, telling Israeli police the Armenians were terrorists. There were scuffles. Police say officers were pushed and that they maintain security for everyone. Still, Setrag worries about the sectarian tension.
Either the Christian world decides to wake up and defend their Christian brothers who are here, defending the lands where Jesus walked, where is the birthplace of Christianity, or we will lose it all and Jerusalem will be lost to Christians.
Across the Old City, at the Jerusalem Intercultural Centre, they've been monitoring the recent rise in attacks and trying to prevent them. They help victims make formal complaints and ask volunteers to accompany Christian processions. The centre's director, Daniel Hassan, urges Israel's religious and political leaders to speak out.
The stakes here are very, very high, And the Old City is important to all the monotheistic religions, which is more than half of humanity. So we have an obligation to look after the special character of our Old City for the sake of all.
Palestinian Christians here feel vulnerable and worry about the future of their declining community. For now, they say, they're clinging onto Easter's message of hope.
Yolan Nell reporting from Jerusalem. Some optimistic news now in the fight against cancer. Scientists here in the UK believe that relics of ancient viruses that have lingered in our DNA for millions of years might help the body fight off cancer. The research has been carried out by the Francis Crick Institute. Its associate research director, Professor Julian Downwood, told Rebecca Kesby more about the viruses in question.
These are remnants of viruses that infected our ancestors hundreds of thousands of years ago. And the viruses have been incorporated into our DNA. So after the infection, sometimes they will have actually remained in the DNA that we pass on from generation to generation. And actually a large portion of the human genome is made up of this sort of viral debris, probably about 8% of it. So there's a lot of this stuff there that really has always been thought of as just being junk left behind by evolution. But it's clear that in some circumstances it can have a function.
Fascinating. So what have your researchers managed to find out about how useful these viruses could be?
Well, we started from our work on lung cancer. What we found was, when we were looking at these lung cancers, was the presence of activity from a different arm of the immune system to what we normally expect to find. Mostly cancers are targeted by a part of the immune system called the T cells, which attack abnormal cells like cancer cells. But we were seeing involvement from the B cells, which produce antibodies, which are generally thought to be more involved in targeting viruses and infectious agents. So we started looking into why these were around in the cancers. And it turned out that what those antibodies are recognizing is these ancient fragments of viral proteins that have ended up in our DNA. So normally these things aren't expressed, they're just completely silenced, and as part of the process of their incorporation into our genomes, they've all been switched off. But in the case of cancers, you get this chaotic rearrangement of things in the cancers, whereby some genes that are normally shouldn't be expressed start to be expressed, and that's what's happening with these ancient viral fragments. So the tumours start to look as though they've been infected with a virus, and that's what those B cells are picking up on and producing antibodies against the viral proteins.
Right, so in a way then, this is aimed at trying to use our own immune systems to fight off cancer. How are you going to trigger these ancient viruses?
So what we can do is potentially to make vaccines that would recognise these ancient viral proteins, then that would mean that the patients would produce more antibodies against these viral proteins that are expressed in the tumour cells, and that would reactivate the immune system against those tumours. So it's a way of boosting the immune system against the tumours, and that could be done by vaccination. The risks with anything where you're manipulating or attempting to manipulate the immune system is that you can get autoimmune problems. The immune response could start affecting healthy tissue. We think that's unlikely in the case of these ancient viruses, because the ancient viruses themselves are completely dead in terms of that they will never produce infectious viruses, so we're not going to sort of reactivate some sort of real viral infection.
Professor Julian Downwood talking to Rebecca Kesby. And still to come.
For me, I think it's important to rebuild it the same way, to show to the world that we still have the capacity.
Rebuilding Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris 4 years after it was engulfed in fire. Poland has been one of the strongest supporters of Ukraine since the Russian invasion. But Polish farmers have been unhappy over an increase in Ukrainian grain exports, which they say is pushing down their prices. So Poland is now banning all agricultural products from Ukraine until the end of June. The Ukrainian government says it regrets the decision. I heard more about the Polish action from our Warsaw correspondent, Adam Easton.
This is a problem for a government which is facing a general election in October, relies on the rural and small town votes for much of its support. As you mentioned, Poland has been one of the staunchest supporters of Ukraine during the war. It's one of the biggest donors of both military and humanitarian aid. But this is about making sure that those voters are not unhappy. And we've had a couple of weeks now of almost daily protests by Polish farmers who say that a mass influx of cheaper Ukrainian imports, instead of going on to other markets in Africa and the Middle East, has remained in Poland because it's been bought by Polish companies, and that has depressed the price of Polish grain, and they're very angry about this.
Does this whole row signal a wider loss of support for Ukraine, or is it just these unique circumstances?
I'd say the latter, the unique circumstances. The Polish agriculture minister has been talking on a daily basis to his Ukrainian counterpart. They informed Ukraine what they were planning to do. So I think Ukraine knows this is a sticky issue for the government, and it doesn't actually affect the broader support that Poland has shown and is showing and will show for Ukraine.
Of course, Ukraine has had difficulties exporting its grain. One of the ways it's been able to do it is across the border into Poland. What will it do now?
Poland and countries like Romania and other neighbours of Ukraine in the European Union were supposed to be transit countries for Ukrainian grain, which traditionally does go to countries like Egypt and elsewhere. And there were concerns when Russia blockaded Ukraine's Black Sea ports of famine if this grain couldn't get to those markets. So the European Union was very keen on setting up these transit corridors through countries like Poland and Romania. But this grain has not got to the intended markets, and it's remained in those countries purely because of price. What happens now in terms of Ukraine exporting to its markets, it won't be happening through Poland for at least until the end of June while this ban remains in force. But it'll have to seek alternative routes.
Adam Easton in Warsaw. The second day of a prisoner swap between the warring parties in the long-running conflict in Yemen has been completed successfully. The International Committee of the Red Cross says 350 detainees were released on Saturday, following more than 300 on Friday. Peace talks have recently started between the Houthi rebel movement and Saudi Arabia, which has been supporting the government during the 8 years of war in Yemen. Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher reports.
Families in the Yemeni capital Sana'a embraced and held fathers and sons they thought they might not see again for many years, if ever. One of those, Fareed, expressed his joy at coming home.
Thank God. What I'm feeling is indescribable. I've never felt like this in my life. It's like I was reborn.
Planes crisscrossed over Yemen and Saudi Arabia for a second day, with flights heading to Houthi-controlled Sana'a from Mocha, a city held by the Yemeni government, and from Riyadh, where the government first sought refuge after being forced out of Yemen by the Houthis in 2015. A smaller number of Saudi prisoners were flown home from Sana'a as part of the prisoner swap. The International Red Cross described the exchange as a glimmer of hope amid great suffering, and it's given further momentum to peace efforts. A Saudi delegation was shaking hands with Houthi leaders just a few days ago, with expectation rising that a possibly permanent ceasefire could be announced this month. That's been helped by the Chinese brokered rapprochement between the Saudis and Iran, which has backed the Houthis. That could see thousands more detainees finally being able to return home.
Sebastian Usher. For the past 6 months, the conservative clerics who run Iran have faced an unprecedented challenge from mainly young protesters, angered by the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in the custody of the morality police. In recent weeks, the authorities have stepped up their crackdown on dissent. Now, an Iranian blogger has been arrested over a video of a woman offering free hugs. Footage shot from inside a car shows the woman with a face mask but no hijab, in defiance of the law. Behind her are paper signs reading Free Hugs. Siavash Ardalan from the BBC Persian Service told us more.
From the statement that the judiciary put out, we know that one of the local bloggers was arrested who was involved in producing and distributing a video in connection with this free hug. Now, we don't know whether that means the girl who was giving the hugs was the blogger or whether she was arrested or not. But because this free hug movement became so politicized, almost like an act of civil disobedience against those social restrictions in place by the clerical regime, there were a lot of individuals involved in spreading that movement at the heights of those protests back a few months ago, as you would remember, over the death of Mahsa Amini, which was coined as the Women Life Freedom Movement, in which women not only took off their headscarves and burned it, but also as part of that movement, they would go out in the streets and give free hugs to people, showing solidarity, in fact, with the protesters.
Is that one of the ways they've been trying to get round the crackdown on protests, because the authorities have been taking quite strong action?
The government is set not to compromise on the issue of compulsory hijab, which is considered as one of its ideological pillars. They've been cracking down hard. This arrest, one among many, is part of this crackdown. And just today, the law enforcement has set in a new enforcement of new measures to enforce compulsory hijab, from the deployment of police forces in crowded areas to using technologies like facial recognition to find women who are not wearing scarves and then, you know, send them letters or penalty notices or arrest them in their cars and impound the cars. So they're very determined not to allow this movement that has began, whether it be free hugs or taking off your scarves, to really take root inside society and spread, you know, to a point where they couldn't be able to control it anymore.
And briefly, does it look like they will be able to stamp out all these protests?
They will. The protests have more or less abated. They might erupt here and there over other things. But let's remember, the government itself is under pressure by religious zealots who think that the state is going too soft in trying to enforce compulsory hijab.
Siavash Adlan of the BBC Persian Service. It is 4 years since the people of Paris watched on in horror as Notre Dame Cathedral was engulfed in flames. The fire destroyed the spire and much of the roof. When the French President Emmanuel Macron promised to rebuild it in just 5 years, many thought he was being wildly optimistic. But as Hugh Schofield in Paris reports, the operation is pretty much on schedule.
On the evening of the 15th of April 2019, this was the dramatic sight on the Ile de la Cité. A bright orange conflagration gradually consuming the glory of sacred architecture that is Notre Dame. And then, with thousands of horrified Parisians watching aghast, the spire crashing climactically into the flames. 4 years on, a couple of hundred miles to the east, and at a site near Metz, they're putting the final touches to the first essential part of the replacement to that spire. It's the base, a frame made out of hundreds of ancient oak trees, which, once assembled, must fit exactly into the masonry at the top of the cathedral walls. Among the team of carpenters is Paul Poulet.
When it burned, I was sad, but when it was announced that it will be rebuilt the same way in wood, I was really happy. For me, I think it's important to rebuild it the same way, to show to the world that we still have the capacity, and it's not because it was an old way to work that we don't know how to do it.
In another provincial French town, Troyes, other craftsmen and women are working on the cathedral's stained glass. Like the spire, these windows are not, in fact, medieval, but from the mid-19th century. Unlike the spire, they survived the blaze. Firefighters knew not to spray them with water, otherwise they'd have shattered in the heat.
Et là, on vient retirer toutes les croûtes noires.
For master glassmaker Flavie Vincent Petit, what happened 4 years ago was ironically an opportunity, a chance to remove from the coloured glass 200 years of dirt.
Think of the millions of people who've come to pray in the cathedral. There is all the human grease from their breaths. Then there is a soot from millions of candles and the stains from condensation. All the particles accumulate and leave their mark.
The interior of Notre Dame is still a weird sci-fi film decor, with a mass of scaffolding reaching up to the hole where the roof once was. But everywhere there's activity. For retired General Jean-Louis Georgelin, the man given the job by President Macron of supervising the reconstruction, the project has every chance of being completed by its target date at the end of next year.
We have said we will do that in 5 years, you know. And we say that at the entire world. So our reputation is at stake. We must unite all our effort, all our knowledge, all our savoir-faire to reach this goal.
December 2024 is when it's hoped the first Mass will be celebrated in the reopened cathedral. December this year is also an important and symbolic date. That's when Parisians should see a new addition to their skyline, or rather, the return of an old one, the spire of Notre Dame.
Hugh Schofield reporting from Paris. The coronation of King Charles III is now less than 3 weeks away. The celebrations include a concert in the grounds of Windsor Castle to be broadcast around the world. As our entertainment correspondent Lisa Mazimba reports, the acts will include Lionel Richie, Katy Perry and Take That.
Gary Barlow is, of course, no stranger to big royal events. He helped organise the Queen's Diamond Jubilee concert in 2012. This time he'll be performing with Take That. Other performers range from pop figures like Lionel Richie to classical singers Sabrine Tervel and Andrea Bocelli. They'll be performing a duet together. Two other artists duetting will be singer-songwriter Freya Ridings and composer and pianist Alexis French.
It feels incredibly special, I think, to be part of a moment in history that is going to celebrate an incredibly momentous, once-in-a-lifetime occasion. In the midst of so many luminaries as well, is just such a thrill.
While the event is designed to display a diverse range of different music, one of the biggest draws is likely to be global superstar Katy Perry. With the thousands at Windsor Castle and the millions watching at home, hoping for the kind of spectacle that the artists performing are famous for.
Lizo Mazimba. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back at the same time tomorrow. This edition was mixed by Rob Fanner and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.